The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation is a roundtable discussion moderated by former Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Randy Shepherd with former Indiana Governors Evan By and Mitch Daniels.
Wow, this is a great crowd. I think it has something to do with our guests today, but we'll see about that. Good afternoon. I'm David Johnson. I'm the president and CEO of the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership of the BioCrossroads Life Sciences Initiative, CICP, and I am privileged this year to be the president of the Indiana Economic Club. 200 years ago yesterday, the President of the United States, James Madison, signed a resolution admitting Indiana as the 19th state of the United States. The new state was sparsely populated and still a frontier, and it quickly earned its nickname as the Crossroads of America, not in those days because of interstates, but because of canals that were trying to traverse the state at that point. And much like neighboring states before it, and many after it, Indiana began as a largely agricultural state, but it really took off with the arrival of the Industrial Revolution and developed into a strong manufacturing hub. And in fact, as all of you know, Indiana remains the most manufacturing-intensive state in the United States today. Now, that manufacturing has changed a lot in 200 years or 175 years. And in fact, present-day Indiana has grown into home base not only for growing information technology companies and marketplace, but also for a whole range of advanced industries across legacy sectors of industry that are exciting and have 21st century possibilities all across the board. Companies like Eli Lilly and Roche and Dow and Cummins, but also companies like Rolls-Royce and Allison and Salesforce, and a number of many smaller companies that are growing up in a new entrepreneurial wave across the state. This was a state that was really driven by entrepreneurs from the beginning, and they are alive and well. At the same time, this state has been very thoughtful and very attentive to growing a tremendous higher education system. This is home to some of the nation's finest colleges and universities. We have someone with us today who can speak to one of those. And we're also, interestingly, for being a small state, we seem to keep intersecting with national politics. So in January, we will send our sixth elected Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence, to Washington, D.C. That's in January. Today, as we are celebrating our bicentennial, we are really honored to have three distinguished public servants with us who have many years combined in serving the state. But if you asked anybody out there who are the three thought leaders on politics, on policy, on the future that you would like to hear from about Indiana, these are the three. These are the three that we all would like to hear from and will hear from. So let me introduce them. In the middle is Evan By, who has been a U.S. Senator from 1999 to 2011. From 1989 to 1997, he served as Indiana's 46th governor. He's currently a partner at McGuire Woods and a senior advisor at Apollo Global Management in New York. Mitch Daniels was sworn in as the 49th governor of Indiana in 2005 and served two distinguished terms. He is currently the president of Purdue University. And then Randall Shepherd was appointed to the Indiana Supreme Court in 1985. He became Chief Justice in 1987, retired from the court in 2012, at which point he was the longest-serving Chief Justice in Indiana's history and the longest-serving leader of a state high court in the nation. So, with the talent we have assembled here today, we're about to have a great conversation. And Randy has brought this group together and has volunteered to moderate a panel, such as it needs moderation. And I think, Randy, I'm going to turn this over to you. I believe everybody may have some initial comments that you all want to make. So this should be fun. Randy, I'm going to have you take it away.
Thank you.
David has reminded me that I've wanted to get on the public record for a long time, one of the cleverest lines ever invented. Justice Mark Massa, while he was working for Mitch Daniels. When he learned of the nomination of Dan Quayle, he repeated it this year, said, "The mother of vice presidents is pregnant again." And turned out to be right. I don't know whether we're number one or number two. We got to be close to the top. Well, thanks for this chance to share with you. As the publicity says, we're going to look backwards and look forward. We're really only going to passingly look backwards, but I've asked my friends to think about one question that has to do with our history that might reflect on our present. And I have an answer or two of my own, but I'll ask Mitch to go first. The question was, what is a person or event or decision in our past that's made tremendous difference in our present and future?
So Randy said a really intimidating thing when we walked up here. He said, "There's an obvious answer to this question."
We'll find out.
Yeah. So I'm in my customary role as Mr. Obvious. Let me see if I've got the one you were thinking of. Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and I flipped back through Professor James Madison, our premier historian on Indiana, his latest update called Hoosiers. If you haven't read it, you should. To me, the obvious answer is the Internal Improvements Act of 1836, which was a very ambitious, audacious, as we say these days, undertaking. They borrowed at that time staggering sum of something like $10 million. They were going to build canals. Internal improvements were the part of the American system of Henry Clay, and Abe Lincoln was big on internal improvements. So Indiana took a big chance, and it blew up in their face. None of the big projects was ever finished. You can still ride a few miles of the Whitewater Canal and places like that that people broke down trying to complete. But the reason I pick it is that it led to two things that I think have stayed with us ever since. One was a new constitution. This was such a fiscally devastating. The state defaulted on all these bonds. We were the subject of derision and animosity all the way to London and places where people had bought these bonds, thought they'd been stolen from and so forth. And so we got a new state constitution, which has some good things in it and maybe some not so good. But anyway, we're still living with that constitution today. It has defects in it. I bet Evan and I agree on this one for sure. It's one of the few constitutions where the governor doesn't, veto can be overridden without a supermajority. A terrible thing we should fix at some stage. But in any event,
we are starting off with a bipartisan agreement.
Yeah. So anyway, we got a new constitution, for better or for worse, has proscriptions against going into debt, which is good thing in my opinion. But the other thing it did, maybe of even greater impact, I think it led to an innate caution about bold endeavors that ran all the way through most of our history. It was 170 years, and I can't think of an exception in between that and the Major Moves Program of 2006, which was the biggest infrastructure program in the country then or since, I mean, relative to the size of the state. And but you know, a lot of time was lost in between. Well, Hoosiers of both parties and all persuasions were very, very cautious about change. If let somebody else try it first. If it's not broke, even if it is, be careful fixing it. So I hope that we're outgrowing that now. But I always said I was a Whig. You know, I really believe in internal improvements and those sorts of things. But it took us a long time to get over that one.
You got a different one? You want to?
Well, actually, that was on my list too. Yeah. I think Mitch is exactly right. That was one of the things, one of the experiences that has marked our state as a more fiscally conservative place. As a matter of fact, I think it was a constitutional amendment that was passed in, I think, 1988, when I was first running for governor, that for the first time, we were one of only two states that we couldn't invest in equities for in our state pension funds. And so the rate of return in our pension funds was lagging the other states, because over long periods of time, although they're more volatile, equities tend to, you know, perform better than bonds. And so that was one of the legacies of that constitution that carried on. I couldn't help but think of something, Mitch, while you were speaking about that constitution. Roger Brannigan, one of our predecessors as governor, had a puckish sense of humor. And in that constitution, it provided that the legislature only met every other year for 60 days. The odd number year, they just would, or the even number year, they just wouldn't meet. And his comment was that the Constitution had it all wrong. They should meet every 60 years for 2 days. So, but that's coming from a governor, where you tend to have institutional view of your responsibilities vis-a-vis the legislature. So, but that was on my list, Randy. I'd mention just two others quickly. And by the way, David, thank you for your very generous comments. It's not often someone gets to hear their own eulogy, so I appreciate your all the nice things you had to say. And let me express my great admiration for Mitch Daniels and his leadership at Purdue and his leadership of our state, and my gratitude for the Chief Justice for his years of service that we spent together in the State House. And we were reminiscing earlier over lunch. Our children back in the day when they were very young actually used to swim together up at the Riviera Club here in Indianapolis. So a lot of wonderful memories. I was going to mention two other things. And the first, there's a statue of another governor in front of the State House, and that's Oliver P. Morton. And it took a lot of courage and a lot of strength for him, in collaboration with Abraham Lincoln, to keep Indiana's troops in the field during the first couple years of the Civil War, because we had a state legislature that was dominated by Copperheads. The predominant population centers at that time were in southern Indiana. There were a lot of southern sympathies there, and they were not amenable to approving the funds to keep the troops in the field. But Governor Morton and Abraham Lincoln worked their way through that. And Indiana had one of the highest rates of fatalities of any state, if not the highest. And you can go to Crown Hill and other places and see the cost that our state paid to keep the Union together, to end slavery. And I think that our state would have been perceived much differently if instead, during the Civil War, we had sort of opted out and had been neutral rather than being firmly aligned with the cause of the North and Abraham Lincoln. And Governor Morton really took a strong hand in making that happen. But the other thing I was going to reference, and I think I may be right, it goes back to the original 1816 Constitution and was carried on, and that is we were one of the very first states to put in our foundational document a commitment for every child to receive a free public education. And that was really path-breaking, because the common school movement under Horace Mann and others really didn't gain steam until later in the 19th century. And so our state was one of the first. Now we can debate, and I think there may be some questions later on about what we need to do to truly fulfill that commitment, particularly to the third of the students who continue to struggle. You know, I think it was just a marvelous expression of Hoosier values that from the very beginning of our state, we realized the importance of education, not only to our economy, but to our democracy and to the basic fabric of the state. And so I would mention that decision along with Governor Morton. And that was actually, Mitch, on my list of what you mentioned, just the three things that would I'd mention.
Well, then, and it creates an educated workforce just in time for the Industrial Revolution. I mean, Indiana is primed. It's the second state to mandate attendance. I mean, it's one thing to have free public schools wall to wall, which we managed to get done before the Civil War, actually, because of those provisions, and quite another too. I'm going to mention two that are probably, I think, are on a smaller scale, but are more recent. One is a decision by the Indiana Supreme Court in the 1930s. The court blinked on public debt, and that is to say, it at a moment when, as I recall it, public housing was in serious need. Agreed that you could create these separate authorities and they could issue their own bonds, and that wasn't municipal debt. And the result of that was school cities and conservation districts, and it whole has changed the character, certainly, of local government. And I agree, by the way, very much with the two you've mentioned. The third one, much more modern, I think even through the administrations of Governor Whitcomb, Governor Bowen, that the state's role in local primary and secondary education was almost entirely financial. The question was, how much of it will we cover as a state? And when Bob Orr put the A-plus program down on the table, from that moment on, including over the weekend, governors and legislators decided that part of the decision-making about what kind of education was needed, what was the minimum best, and how was it going to be organized, became both a local and a state decision, and that has changed the dialogue very dramatically. Well, let me ask looking forward, Evan, there's a lot of talk this year in our state about infrastructure. What does Indiana need to do to win or come as close to winning as we can in an international marketplace. What do you think are Indiana's most important infrastructure needs?
Well, we are the crossroads of America, and so maintaining the quality of our highways and bridges is vitally important to our economy. We've got some great state port facilities that are important in airports. And I've always wished, Mitch, we could do a little bit more with that Gary Airport because that's just a jewel up there. I'd always hoped that that could be to the Chicago area what Newark has been to the New York area.
Amen.
But that's a longer conversation. But one thing I would mention is particularly for our smaller towns and rural areas, making sure that broadband is available to all of our citizens, even in those kind of places. It's vitally important to being economically relevant, socially involved these days, and there's a real potential that we may see a sort of a reshoring of some kinds of employment to our smaller towns and rural areas, depending on the activity, but they got to be connected to the web, and they've got to be able to communicate and exchange information and all the other things we do. And so I really think that we've got to focus on that in addition to the more traditional types of infrastructure so that those parts of our state just aren't cut off from the kind of vibrant future I think they can enjoy if they can be, technologically connected.
Is that likely the best payoff of the ones you've listed, ports, roads? Is the internet connection maybe the best bang for the buck on that list, or are there some others?
I'd have to ask an economist about that. That'd be my guess. You catch less hell for it than you do in improving 37 South, for example, but I attended the IU game on Saturday, happened to notice that project. But in any event, probably, but they're all important for different reasons. And we are a great distribution center still of physical goods, and so you've got to have physical infrastructure to do that. Continuing at the cutting edge technologically in the information economy, the innovation economy that we've got, I would put that at the top of my list. Mm.
Mitch, I want to say thank you to you. Every time I make the trip to my hometown, I sing your praises. It's a whole lot easier and better. It's safer, faster. And
it was all about you, Randy.
There are hundreds of thousands of people who share my sense of gratitude. What does Indiana most need to prevail in the international economy?
Well, I mean, Evan said it well. We've got, last I checked, statistically faster broadband on average than most places, but there are pockets that don't, and it's a moving target. So absolutely, I think this belongs high on the list. If you'd asked me first, I would have started with the Gary Airport in terms of that was a frustration. I still have it, list in my left-hand bottom drawer of mistakes and things we didn't get done. And that was always one that irritated me because, just as Evan said, this could be an economic driver, a significant driver for our northwest corner. And it's been tangled up, not for reasons of merit, but provincial and political reasons for a long time. And we made some improvements there, but nothing that really brought it to its potential. But also, let me say this about the rest. I've already said, I'm a Whig, I believe in this. This is a very central role of government. To make sure that the backbone of the economy, the infrastructure in all its forms is strong. And I'm not suggesting for a minute that we're done, but 69 is built, and the Ohio River bridges are built, and 31 to South Bend is built, and the Hoosier Heartland Corridor is built, and the Fort DePort Road from Fort Wayne to Toledo, and on. A third of the bridges in this state got rebuilt over the last 10 years. So we're not doing bad. CNBC rated Indiana as the number one infrastructure in the country. I don't know exactly what they're measuring, but they're close. I like the answer. I guess I'd just say this when we try to look forward. We better make sure we're thinking about the economy that's coming and not the one that we're in or the one we've known. If the autonomous vehicle, just to take one example, happens as effectively and as fast as many people are now predicting, we're not going to need as many lane miles of highways because cars and vehicles are going to be moving much closer together than they do now. You may not need mass transit in places where you thought you might, because this may be a superior answer. So I think we better keep an eye on these fast emerging technologies and make our investment decisions accordingly.
I mean, interestingly, Mitch, I was with a really smart person recently who,
contrast to today, for instance.
No.
No, with you there.
Actually, a lot like today. But it was his opinion that 10 years from now, to your point, 10 years from now, long-haul, over-the-road trucking will be a thing of the past. These will be self-driving trucks. Now, they'll stop at distribution centers in close proximity to cities like Indianapolis. But just think about that. I'm sure it'll be more efficient, more cost-effective, more productive. But just think about that, how that's going to dislocate that part of the labor market. And he thought that was within a decade. So we do have that.
One, will they still take very long time to pass one another so that we can't...
Do we know that? Autonomous vehicle arriving one day after they take my driver's license. Until then, I'm not too happy about the idea.
I'll tell you just one story about a major infrastructure project that might have happened. It wasn't the Gary Airport. I don't know if I've ever told you this, Mitch, but we had an agreement with the state of Illinois. Jim Edgar was governor, good Republican, and the mayor of Chicago, Mayor Daley in those days, to build a new bi-state airport. It was going to be half in Indiana, half in Illinois. The beauty of the thing was Chicago was going to pay for it all. We had no money in the deal. Off their passenger fees off of O'Hare and Midway, they were desperate to expand. They couldn't get more runways at O'Hare, and so they agreed to this deal. And everything, we had an announcement up there. It was beautiful. And you'll like this, too. They did some study in Illinois before we agreed to the deal, wanted to have a tax equalization zone in a 50-mile circumference around the airport because they knew the differential in tax rates, and so they kind of figured out where the first wave of development would take place. One going to be in Illinois. So not having been born yesterday, we didn't agree to that. But in any event, where I'm going with the story is, so we make this big announcement. There's going to be billions of dollars of infrastructure investment. Unfortunately for us, the flight path on the new airport went right over the district of the President Pro Tem of the Illinois State Senate, a guy named Pate Phillip. He literally went in to see Governor Edgar and said, Jim, you can have a state budget, or you can have an airport, but you can't have both. Naturally, the governor chose the budget, so that was the end of that. But that might have revolutionized things up there.
One of the things that's going to be revolutionized is one of our classic advantages, the low cost of energy. Our reliance on coal has been a problem and a blessing both, but that's going to shift, Mitch. And what's that shift going to mean to us as the nation and perforce Indiana move into solar and gas? And
well, it's one of the perversities I thought of the last 15 or 20 years that sitting on a lot of coal, Indiana was always spending $1 billion plus to import it from somewhere else due to characteristics of the coal and so forth. And we had a very conscious policy to try to find clean ways to use it. I always said, let's pay ourselves, pay Hoosiers for it, as I'm tired of paying people in Wyoming or somewhere. So that's what led to an electrical plant with sequestration possibilities for the CO2. That's what led to the attempt to build a coal-to-gas plant, which was eventually undone, really, by the revolution in natural gas. And one of these days, I still can imagine a coal-to-liquids plant here and produce fuels, all these ways to use the energy we were given in environmentally acceptable ways. But the shale gas breakthroughs are just spectacular. I mean, set Indiana aside for a minute. As a nation, this is the single highest card our economy's been dealt in this century anyway. And I hope we maximize the possibilities. From an Indiana standpoint, as a manufacturing state, energy, affordable, reliable energy, and in particular, or in specific, natural gas in many, many cases, is an incredibly important advantage. And so I look forward to buttress our manufacturing, much of our manufacturing base, at least in the intermediate term, while it replaces coal in less carbon-intensive ways that allows us, I hope, to maintain our advantage all Hoosiers share as individual ratepayers or as employees in some of the nation's lowest cost energy.
It's as much an international question as it is a local.
You know, I think we ought to use all the Indiana coal we can. I agree with Mitch that this has been one of the most transformative technological developments of the last half century, the ability to extract large quantities of natural gas and oil from places that previously we couldn't have, and so it's driven down the price of natural gas, which is great for consumers, it's great for manufacturing. I think you'll see a lot of reshoring back to the United States, particularly in the petrochemical area, plastics, things that tend to use a lot of natural gas. There may be some opportunities for us in those arenas, and there's also a huge geopolitical issue here. I hope we can maybe use this as an opportunity to help wean the Western Europeans off of Russian gas, where they're so dependent right now. And the last thing, Randy, I'll say, I've been around long enough. I was sitting on the banking committee when Alan Greenspan came in to testify. And at that point, he said one of the most important things we could do for the U.S. economy was to construct terminals on our coasts for the importation of liquefied natural gas. We're now in the process of constructing those terminals, but it's to export liquefied natural gas. And that's changed in 15 years. And it's just amazing, breathtaking how quickly that's changed.
One last factoid. There was not a new fertilizer plant built in the United States for 25 years. And when this development happened, investors from all over the world began looking here. We licensed the first one down on the Ohio River that Indiana had seen in forever, and a second one is seeking, last I checked, still seeking the necessary permits to move forward. And this is a high-value-added manufacturing with some good jobs attached.
Well, speaking of value-added, the question of how we create a workforce that is capable of grabbing all these opportunities is got to be close to the top of the list. Mitch, what does Indiana need to do to create people who are both good citizens and talented for the next economy?
The answer to so many questions starts with a better K-12 system, so I'll just say that and leave it there. But it can't be, you can't address this or a lot of other important issues I could mention without starting there. So past that, we have 750,000 Hoosiers who got some post-secondary education and never finished a credential or certificate. And nobody's found the right answer yet, but we've got that. There's some low fruit and some real upside possibilities that I hope we can seize. More and more people are recognizing that a bachelor's degree from a four-year school, I'm happy to be part of one that produces those, an institution that produces those, but there are, as we all know now, I think, a large number of skilled jobs that pay very well going begging in this state and in this country. And they have nothing to do really with a Purdue 4-year or more degree. And so, getting serious about that in the way that I know Ivy Tech is now is another real good possibility. But let me just, point out that there's another way that people I always overlook. You know, for the last 3 or 4 years, Indiana has taken in, we've had a net in-migration of college graduates. So everybody in the room either has experienced or seen close hand that talented young person who got a good education and went somewhere else, at least temporarily. A lot of them come back. But we all have, and I, first among them, have worried about that, and we should. But what we've noticed less is that this worm has turned somewhat. And there's a lot, you know, another way to have more college graduates is to import them. And some of the great businesses that are growing around central Indiana and other places are bringing college graduates who started life somewhere else into the state. The margin's not big yet, but if we can sustain that over time, it'll start to address this problem. So that's another way to skin the cat.
I want to take you back right to your very beginning, though. At the moment, at least in the public press, the big discussion is how to finance pre-K, and not how do we finish up all those degrees that are unfinished, and how do we expand higher education. I guess one would be loath to say one's more important than the other, but it seems to me the public dialogue hasn't recognized the higher ed needs in quite the way that we've got this easy to understand project that will have value, but isn't at the end of the road. You got a view on that? You're in favor of higher ed or both?
I do think we have to explore even more earlier in life. Ours was the administration that made full day kindergarten universal in Indiana. It's something that Evan had worked on and his successor, and it took a while to get there. So, and I'm convinced that was a big step forward that some folks have quickly forgotten. The evidence is mixed on pre-K, but I do believe it's worth a try, certainly if it's done surgically and in a targeted fashion. It just has to be said that fundamental problems for too many of our young people are cultural. You can't blame this on the education system. It has its defects. But when far too many children are coming from households where education is not reinforced, is not revered, when nobody's checking the homework, when nobody's reading to them when they're 2 and 3 and 4 years old, you've got a problem. I don't think pre-K really can fix it, but it can help if it's done well. And there's evidence that in some places, brought to the right children, it can help. And so I do believe we're obliged to try.
Yeah, I agree with what Mitch just said about, I think it needs to start earlier. I'm a proponent of more pre-K. It's got to be voluntary. We're children that age. You can't, mandate what families are doing. But making that opportunity available for those who want to avail themselves for it, I think does pay dividends over time. It was amazing the percentage of kids who show up in now kindergarten or used to be first grade developmentally, a year or two behind. They can catch up. Many of them do, but it's just a lot harder, and you've got to spend a lot of money on remedial activities. But a lot of that is cultural, unfortunately. Back in the day, when I was deeply involved in education policy, and I would bet it's still the same, the two most accurate predictors of academic success: quality of the classroom professional, parental involvement. And in fact, that might be reversed. Does at least one parent care and is paying attention and communicating to that child that going to school, that learning is important? The kids pick up on that. And when Susan was our first lady, she started a non-for-profit to deal with illiteracy, and found that illiteracy ran in families, not because it was hereditary or genetic, that's not the case, but because if mom and dad didn't read, well, then there was no newspaper, no periodical, then the children were less likely to read. So a lot of it does come back to some cultural and family changes, and we got to get the parents involved if we're going to make real progress on this.
I want to ask one more topic, and then happily, David Johnson has sorted out some great questions from our audience. Evan, it's been an article of faith. Maybe it lasts all the way back to the internal improvements experience, that a key to Indiana is low taxes. Most of the things that are on our plate now, we now have the lowest income tax rate that we've had in a long time. We've had very, surprising to me, very high sales tax rate. But is there a way to do some of these initiatives and still keep that idea of that low tax is the most important thing? You'd always hope you could, but I wonder whether there's really enough revenue on the table is what I guess I'm asking.
Well, now that I won't be running for office again, I can tell you what I really think. Yeah. look, I've always been a little more conservative on these kind of things for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think freedom's a good thing. And the more we can allow our citizens to enjoy the fruits of your labors and to keep as much of your money as you've earned as possible, I think that's a good thing. Number two, I think in general, free markets tend to be better allocators, efficient allocators of capital than large government bureaucracies. But there are some things that the markets don't do. We were talking about public infrastructure is one. Making sure that every family has access to affordable education may be another. And so the question then is, at the margins, Randy, for those, for me, my first question, whenever someone would come to me and propose raising revenue, was always, okay, what are we going to do with it, and what is the return on that going to be? And there better be a way of accountability to make sure we're actually getting the benefits that you're proposing. Otherwise, folks will just think we're taking their money and they're not getting anything for it. So my answer would be, sure, from time to time you need money to do things like have great universities or public infrastructure or affordable, and high-quality public education system. But you got to have a system of accountability. Otherwise, you run the risk of not only getting the results that you want, but losing the faith of the public that's necessary to achieving that in the first place. So that's a long way of saying, what's the benefit? What's the rate of return if you're going to raise money on that investment you're going to make? And how are you going to hold people accountable for actually achieving it? That's really the... I used to say that to my liberal friends all the time. Yeah. I said, you want more money? Well, you better prove to people it's going to be worthwhile. And, that's really the
challenge.
They
rarely believed you, but you really meant it, didn't they?
I did.
Yeah.
I can tell you some stories about that,
yeah,
too.
Bet.
So my nickname when I was governor, at least for part of my party, Mitch Days, used to call me Ebenezer, because I was like to be careful with the money.
Mitch, how does our attitude about taxation affect our ability to get things done?
Well, there's more than one way to raise more revenue. Mm-hmm. If you want to do big things, you need revenue. But there are ways, and the single best way, the most productive way, is to have a growing economy with more. I always used to say we don't need higher tax rates. We need more taxpayers, more people making more money. And not always, but in most cases, an approach like Evan just outlined is more conducive to the economic growth and therefore the natural organic growth of revenues that does give government the opportunity to do the things that it ought to do. You know, I can name a lot of states, one to our immediate west and a couple on the coast, who wish they had more of an aversion to higher taxes because they're caught in what may be death spirals. You know, more people left California the last two or three years than moved in. That's never happened in the history of America. You know, they've got themselves in a situation, you've read about this, where literally 1 or 2% of all the taxpayers are paying a majority of the, certainly the income taxes. And that's a formula for failure. So, you know, this properly constructed, I once proposed that a temporary surtax for a very specific purpose, to eliminate the debt the state had. Yeah. We couldn't make that happen. Fine. We found another way to do it. Took a little longer. But yes, for a specific worthy purpose, I think people can support it. But, there's some good work that Matt Wild at the University of Indianapolis has done recently. Illuminate something I always knew was true. The standard of living in this state is well above the national average. The only reason that people misrepresent this is they haven't noticed how low the cost of living is here and how low the taxes are. So your standard of living is determined by how much money's left in your pocket and what it'll buy. And we're about 20th on the way up. So we want to be pretty careful, I think, jeopardizing what is now one of the most attractive business climates in the country. A fiscal situation, which Evan contributed to protecting and which some of the rest of us did, which says to individuals and says to businesses, you come to Indiana, you are very unlikely to get a rude surprise and some sort of terrible collapse of services or a big jump in your taxes. I think it's been a secret to some progress we've made, and we just want to, there can be exceptions, but in general, I think that policy serves us well.
One of our questions is...
One quick thing, Randy. I think the chances of there being comprehensive corporate tax reform are really pretty good under the new president and with the new Congress, and that there's a chance that they'll really rework the individual side of the code as well. The reason I mention that, Mitch, I think what Governor Daniels said will be even more so if you look at the Treasury Secretary designate said that they're going to eliminate a lot of the deductions and preferences in the code. And if they eliminate the deduction for state and local taxes, well, then some of these places like New York and California, where the citizens there go, well, yeah, I'm paying a lot more, but I can deduct it off my federal return, so the hit's not quite so bad. Suddenly, they're not going to be able to do that anymore.
Which translates into those suckers out in Indiana are subsidizing me.
Well, yeah. Anyway, successful people in those places may be leaving in droves at that point, right. And we'll be awfully happy to, as we might say, become Hoosiers by choice.
Well, one of our audience members has a, speaking of finance, an idea that I'd never contemplated, monetizing assets, which is what the major moves amounted to and what the Pence administration's proposed transaction on the cell towers has to do with. And the proposal is, why not sell the Hoosier Lottery or lease it for 50 years? Are there other assets like that? I mean, that would produce a huge amount of money.
We proposed that, actually, although not quite, not the whole enchilada. We proposed, on the heels of major moves, we asked exactly that question. I think this is a very plausible thing. Some will recall, we proposed not monetizing, not leasing the entire proceeds of the lottery. We said Indiana will continue to receive the then just over $200 million it's gotten, but we'll freeze it there. And we will. Who wants to bid for the growth over time? And we were able to value that at over $1 billion. This is 2007, I guess. But the legislature did not agree, so it didn't happen. It was all to be invested in higher education, by the way. So I tried it twice, two different ways. You know, the thing that has gotten a lot of publicity down in Tennessee, where they've offered everybody, or at least up to a certain income level, a couple years at the community college, that's our idea.
We even called it, we even had the same label of the Hoosier Promise for it. And that's how we were gonna endow it with the proceeds. So, in any such question should be approached just the way every business person in the audience would. If you've got an asset that you think is not performing as well as you think it could, and someone else thinks they could earn a higher return on it, absolutely you should consider converting that asset with one critical proviso. The proceeds have got to be reinvested in another long-term asset. You can't be using them to pay operational costs. You can't take tomorrow's revenue and pull it forward to today. And as long as you're doing that, as long as you're reinvesting it in something, higher education, I-69/31, et cetera, that you think will bring a bigger return or a better public return over time, then absolutely you should look at it. Mm-hmm.
You know any law firms that could help facilitate an arrangement like this?
I'm not in that business.
You might want to keep your eyes out. Let me start on another question, unless you want to add to that in some way. One of our friends in the audience says, in a federal environment where the claim is or the plan is to roll back a number of existing regulations that seem to affect the business climate, are there some of those that would make more difference in Indiana of the list that you've seen?
Well, I think some of the environmental ones would make a bigger difference. The Clean Power Plan, for example, there are some things that would threaten to drive up the cost for, you know, Hoosier Utilities, ratepayers, businesses. So I think a number of those rules and regulations will be walked back. The Dodd-Frank legislation, some of that will be unwound, and that'll have an impact on our state, but not as much as some of the places where the big money center banks are headquartered and that kind of thing. I've already mentioned, you know, taxes, but that's going to be legislative, not regulatory. But then obviously the big one also would be the Affordable Care Act, and that will be repealed, and the question is, you know, how long they will allow a grace period for a replacement. There are some, and Mitch might know more about this than I do, but there's some within the Republican Party who are advocating for a very quick replacement. Others who will say, you know, no, this is going to take some time. And if you move very quickly, you run the risk of destabilizing the insurance markets, particularly in the individual sector of the health insurance market, which is about 12% of Americans. And finally, you know, Governor Pence did make, with some, I thought, thoughtful adjustments, the decision to participate in the Medicaid expansion, which for those of you in the audience, and I do know some who are in the on the provider side of things, this helped to deal with the problem of uninsured, who then the cost for caring for them get passed on to others, driving up the cost of insurance for everybody else. Is that repealed? It would be as a part of the, if they just have a flat-out repeal, or is that grandfathered in? Again, that's legislatively, but there will be a lot of regulatory decisions, too, on the healthcare front that will impact our state. But I think so, it would be mostly legislatively when the Affordable Care Act is repealed. What is it replaced with, if anything? But mostly, that's a long free association way of saying probably energy, Randy.
Yeah. Want to add to that?
I'll just say this. I don't know which path they'll take forward on the Affordable Care Act. It's imploding, and they're going to have to do something. Even most of its original advocates agree with that. But there's every chance that an Indiana-born program will soon be national in some form. As Evan pointed out, by far, most of the newly covered people under the Affordable Care Act are in Medicaid, which isn't necessarily a good thing because it's provably the worst health care in America. In Oregon, they did a study a few years ago and found out that people on Medicaid had worse health outcomes than people who had no insurance at all. So, but that's where most of the, whatever it is, 11 million net new coverees are. Now, I think there's a high, whatever they do to the Affordable Care Act and its exchanges and its penalties and its subsidies and its mandates and all that, I think there's a high possibility that something that governors of both parties have asked for a long time, which is free our hands on Medicaid, is going to happen. And I think there's every chance that the outlines of the Healthy Indiana Plan of a few years ago, which is the basis of the Medicaid expansion that Evan mentioned here, might be applied nationally, because it's always attracted a lot of attention and some supporters, and actually a very talented woman who was certainly one of our important mechanics in putting the thing together years ago is now the head of CMS, the agency that runs Medicare and Medicaid. So maybe we'll have an export of an Indiana idea. Let's see.
Well, we've come to the end of the hour, but I'm happy to say that one of the questions we won't have time to answer, but has a wonderful sentiment embedded in it. How do we keep our momentum for growing Indiana? A question that came in that poses a lot of questions, but also suggests a recognition that we're in good times and have the potential for better. Thanks to both of you. Thanks for giving us the chance to muse on these questions, members of the Economic Club.
Gentlemen, thank you. That is the fastest 50 minutes I think any of us have ever had at one of these luncheons. That was just terrific. Thank you very much. This presentation will be broadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Saturday, January 14th. It will also be available for download at WFYI.org. Please join us next month on Tuesday, January 24th, as we welcome keynote speaker Bill Hansen, who's the president and CEO of USA Funds. Information and tickets for each of this season's presenters can be found on our website at theeconomicclubofindiana.com. Have a terrific holiday season. Thank you.
You've been listening to a speech from the Economic Club of Indiana, part of the 2016-2017 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Join us next month at this time for a speech from Bill Hansen, President and CEO of USA Funds. You can find more information at economicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.